Archiving started.
All right. Good morning or good afternoon, wherever you are in the world. This is Janet Warburton and Sarah Crowley. We work with ARCUS here in Fairbanks, Alaska, and we're excited to be hosting this Polar Connect event with Mike League and the research team that's based in McMurdo Station in Antarctica. We know that Mike has a great program going on, and he's going to be talking about the adaptations of marine worms and other things related to energy use and adaptations in Antarctica. And today is September 27th, 2011. And I think Mike and Chris, do you guys want to introduce yourselves and where you're at? I guess, Chris, mostly introduce yourself since Sarah and I don't know who you are and who you have in the room. That'd be great.
All right. My name is Chris Lenhart. I'm an eighth-grade science teacher at Beacon Middle School in Cape and Lupin School District, and I am currently at the Department of Ed. We are having the Transformation of Energy Unit training. I am here with about 14, 15 teachers from all across the state, and we're looking forward to chatting with Mike about what's going on.
Okay, most excellent. And Mike is chatting away down there. Before we turn this over to him, I just want to give your group a little bit of background in case they're not familiar with Polar Trek, but and why Mike might be in Antarctica. He has joined a program that is funded by the National Science Foundation and administered by the Arctic Research Consortium of the United States. That's ARCUS for short. And we're based in Fairbanks, Alaska. We're a nonprofit that works with scientists around the world and in Arctic issues and helps support them. The Polar Trek program is a program for teachers, so if you're a teacher and you get excited about what Mike is doing down in Antarctica, I'm going to put a plug in that our application period for teachers to go to the Arctic and the Antarctic is closing this Friday, September 30th, so there's still time. If you want to join us next year in the Arctic or the Antarctic, we encourage you teachers to apply to our program. And I'm sure Mike can tell you all how exciting it is. But we put teachers with researchers in the field so that they can learn about, get hands-on science and bring that back to their classroom and become better science teachers. And we're funded for a couple more years, and we are very proud of our program, and we hope that you will get a lot out of following Mike as well as the other teachers. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to you, Mike, and we got your title slide, and I'll let you go.
Well, thanks very much for that introduction. On this end, Janet, the slides are not showing up. Chris, are they showing up on your end?
Yes, I got them.
There is a delay, Mike.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. It's good morning here. I am currently located in McMurdo Station, Antarctica, and there's about an 18-hour time difference. So although it's your Tuesday afternoon at TOE training, it is my Wednesday morning at 6 a.m. So good morning to me. It is a beautiful morning here at McMurdo Station. The temperature is 6 below zero, and there is very little wind. So here, that's quite pleasant. If you go to the next slide, Janet.
We're there.
As Janet mentioned, I'm with a team of researchers, and this slide will show you our team. They are composed of Dr. Adam Marsh from the University of Delaware, Dr. Stacy Kim from Moss Landing Marine Laboratory in Santa Cruz, California, Stephanie Guida and Anna Marie Pasqualoni, who are graduate students at the University of Delaware, and then you're speaking with me, Mike League. I'm on the right of the slide. If you go one more slide, Janet, the reason that I've asked for the opportunity to speak with you is that, like you, I spend most of my time in an eighth-grade classroom. So if I were not here right now at McMurdo Station, like you, I'd be working with 13- and 14-year-olds, where science meets education. And I sort of have a unique opportunity here to blend those two very well in an extreme environment. So let's talk a little bit about where I am and why I think this might be useful to you in the classroom and to your students. If you will go to the next slide, Janet, you should be looking at a map of our location. For those folks that aren't too familiar with Antarctica, we are not at the South Pole, which is a common misconception. We are at the U.S.'s largest research facility on McMurdo Station. McMurdo Station is actually on a little island called Ross Island, and it is in the middle of a frozen ocean at this time. So completely surrounding our island is sea ice, thick enough for you to land an airplane on. And so we are working in that environment. If you go to the next slide, you'll see what it's like here on the ground. And a lot of people are surprised to find that McMurdo Station is a bit like a small city. There are over 100 heated buildings here that house everything from electricians to carpenters, plumbers, and, of course, scientists. If you go to the next slide, Janet. One thing that is part of your eighth grade curriculum is teaching seasons and why we have seasons. And I find comparisons make teaching seasons a very worthwhile endeavor and a little bit easier for students. And if you take a look at this graph, you'll see that the curve for Delaware, where we are found, is sort of inverse to the McMurdo curve. And you can use that example to talk to students about Northern Hemisphere versus Southern Hemisphere and our seasons. We deployed in August, which if you'll look at the curve, August is actually the lowest point on the blue line. McMurdo's coldest average temperatures, and it's one of Delaware's highest points. So we went from extreme summer to sort of extreme winter. We go to the next slide, Janet. The nice part about deploying in August is that McMurdo is just coming out of its winter, and so you get all this beautiful light. And this slide, and if you go to the next slide, shows you some of the surroundings. We are surrounded by a mountain chain called Transantarctic Mountains. This is the Royal Society Range. And the colors that are produced in August with the low-level sunlight are simply beautiful. One more slide, Janet. This will show you Castle Rock and Mount Erebus in the background. Nestled right up close to McMurdo is Mount Erebus, the southernmost active volcano in the world. And so our island is mostly volcanic and then surrounded by a frozen ocean. So we really have this interesting juxtaposition of geology and then sea ice. And one more slide will show you some of the beautiful weather that we've seen and we don't see in Delaware. These are called nacreous cloud or polar mesospheric clouds. These clouds are super high in the mesosphere, and they produce these beautiful colors. We don't get them in Delaware. On the next slide is a little graph of temperature patterns and wind chill. You guys are probably working up to activity 8, or maybe you just passed activity 8. Chris, would that be true?
Right, dead on.
So at the end of Activity 8 in the Transformation of Energy Unit, there's a really neat extension on wind chills and why we wear coats. And I thought this graph would be very appropriate for students who might be interested to see that very rarely do we have days here, or have we had days during our expedition that have been above zero. Most of our days have been quite chilly, with negative 40 being sort of the average, and even wind chills down to 80 below. Next slide, please. You should be looking at a picture that I thought was very appropriate for eighth graders, and that's Anna Marie and myself with some arrows drawn in to show the transfer of heat energy. You can see the weather report there that says that it's negative 40 with a wind chill of negative 81. The idea to convey to students is that we feel cold because heat energy is transferring away from our body, and what we wear is designed to slow down that transfer. If you're all dressed in your extreme cold weather gear, and if you go to the next slide, Janet, you'll see the extreme cold weather gear that we wear. That extreme cold weather gear slows down that transfer and keeps us warmer for longer. But without it, we get cool very quickly out here on the sea ice. Next slide. One last thing that's been interesting about deploying in August is the rapid change in daylight. And this has to do, again, with seasons and our extreme latitude. In Delaware, during the spring to summer, we gain 1 to 2 minutes of daylight every day. Here at McMurdo, we've been gaining on average 15 to 20 minutes every day. So when we first deployed, we were in the lower left-hand corner of this graph, receiving about 2 hours of daylight every day. It was sort of in the middle of the day, sort of a dusk dawn type of light. By now, we're actually up over 13 hours of daylight, and it's changed in the course of just 3 weeks, 4 weeks. A pretty amazing example. And as Janet says in the text box, the Arctic Circle is the exact opposite. And so when they're up in Fairbanks, they're losing light at the rate of a half hour a day as they transition to their long, dark winter. Next slide, please. Okay, so what we're doing here at McMurdo is actually part of a scientific expedition. And we're studying the adaptations of marine worms that live in the sediment beneath the sea ice underwater. And so there is a lot of natural enthusiasm on the part of students, and your eighth graders would be a great example of this, for the types of activities that we've been involved in. You can see that we've been drilling holes in the sea ice. We've been scuba diving under the ice, collecting sediment, sorting worms, and taking tons of photo and video that are all available to your students to use in your classroom. Next slide, please. At McMurdo, energy has become a primary concern in just about everything that is done here. And this is kind of a great example of that. It takes a lot of energy to operate a drill with a 4-foot auger bit to create a hole in sea ice that is sometimes 6 to 10 feet thick. And the reed drill is the primary process where we do that. If you go to our website, we'll talk a little bit more about that at the end. There's a nice video that allows you to click and play, and it'll show you the process of drilling through the sea ice and what happens when you punch through to the water below. Next slide, please. It is so cold here that the scientists need to scoop out the ice that builds up over the hole. And so you can see Dr. Marsh and myself here in our extreme cold weather gear trying to get the ice out of our dive hole. And you can see the dive hut behind us, which if you go to the next slide, is what we drag over the top of the dive hole to keep it open and also to keep the divers happy. It's much more pleasant getting dressed in a heated dive hut than it is out cold on the sea ice. If you go to the next slide, you'll see what an average dive sort of looks like. We begin with a preparation in the dive locker, getting all of our dive gear sorted. You can see there some of the dive gear that we use. We dive in dry suits with lots of insulation on underneath. Again, another powerful example to students of the use of insulators, a big part of the transformation of energy, heat energy section of the unit. We wear lots of gloves, hoods, typical scuba equipment like masks and fins. The tanks that we use are standard tanks. We breathe air, except you'll notice that there are many more hoses than what come off of a standard scuba tank. For any divers in the classroom, we dive with redundant regulators because with the extreme cold water here, it's 28 degrees Fahrenheit, right at the freezing point of seawater. Equipment failure is not just a possibility, it's a probability. And so you have to have redundant systems to be able to be safe underneath the ice. If you go to the next slide, one thing that really excites eighth graders and also talking about the uses of energy and fossil fuels, ways we get around in Antarctica. Lots of different modes of transportation, very different than what students are used to seeing on the roads, and also really powerful examples of transforming chemical potential energy in the fossil fuel to kinetic energy, and really a backbone of our operation here is being able to get around on the sea ice. The next slide shows you what we've been using to get around. This is a piston buoy. Piston buoys are fabulous vehicles for the sea ice and also for transporting dive equipment. If you you go to the next slide, when we're out in the field, another great example, and the way that I'm able to communicate with you today is because of electromagnetic waves. I know you haven't talked about energy waves yet in your training, but you will when you get to activities 12, 13, and 14 on the last day. And electromagnetic waves are really essential to our communication. And we use satellite phones and radio primarily to talk around the station and also with the continental U.S. And other countries. So electromagnetic waves are really important to the research and the work that gets done down here. If you go to the next slide, when we drive along in our piston buoy and we're out in the field, we see scenes like this. And you should be looking at a sort of a frozen ocean with islands, and that's sea ice. What's hard to see in the picture is what's underneath. And so if you can imagine in your mind, beneath that is 6 feet of ice, frozen ocean, and then beneath that, thousands of feet of water, some of the coldest water in the world, and that's where we're going to collect our marine worms. I still don't see any slides on mine, so I'm going to pause here for a moment and just ask Chris and Janet, are you guys on that slide?
Yep, we've got the slide, and Chris has a question, I think, for you. So go ahead, Chris. I interrupted you.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, we're looking at the same slide. It's absolutely breathtaking. But when you dive, is it just air tanks, or does it actually have nitrogen?
Yeah, so I apologize for not being able to text. I got to hold the talk button at the same time. So I started that text section and then realized I'm not really sure I can do that. So apologies for that. We only dive air. We dive very conservatively here. The general medical belief is that the really cold water makes our bodies more susceptible to what's called decompression sickness. And for those folks unfamiliar with that idea, when you breathe air, you also take in nitrogen. And the nitrogen under pressure dissolves into your bloodstream, creating these very tiny bubbles. The problem is when you come up from depth with less water pressure on your system, the bubbles slightly expand. If they expand too much, they cut off blood flow and create all sorts of problems. So the short answer to your question is, Chris, no, we don't use nitrox. And the primary reason being we dive very conservative dive tables. There's no decompression diving in at McMurdo, and we always do a safety stop to allow our bodies to off gas at about 15 feet for about 3 minutes. So a great question, and thanks for asking. If you go to the next slide, you'll see another picture of Mount Erebus, sort of, again, the beautiful sort of low light that we've been seeing. And if you look very carefully in the foreground, you can actually see our little orange dive hut. And so it's pretty tremendous diving right next to an active volcano in Antarctica. Next slide. One of the amazing things about sea ice, and there's two journal entries on our website about sea ice, and this could tie directly to what your students did in sixth grade, but there are a tremendous number of forces acting on the ice. And those forces sort of cause the transfer of kinetic energy through the ice. And where the ice can't move, you generate these cracks. Cracks, of course, are a problem. Driving over cracks safely can be the difference between a great day in the field and between sinking a vehicle, a very expensive vehicle. And so there's a lot of science that goes on with sea ice and sea ice safety, being able to operate out in the field and get to our dive sites, but a really interesting area. If you go to the next slide, you'll see some of these cracks. The sea ice cracks are beautiful. We see all sorts of interesting features in the ice. It never is flat, plain. There's always sort of pressure ridges and then cracks, all interesting to students as well. If you go to the next slide, at the end of our drive over this frozen wasteland, we arrive at our dive hut, and the first order of business is to suit up in our gear. You'll see Dr. Adam Marsh on the left of this picture and myself on the right getting ready for a dive. And again, there are journal entries on our website that allow you to look at what the divers wear and all the layers and the insulation. Again, all nice ties to the heat energy section of transformation of energy unit. If you go to the next slide, the reason we take so long in preparing is because we're about to jump in this 28-degree water, and here you can get a glimpse through the dive hole, seeing the hole that we created through the ice. A lot of students are interested in how we find our way back. It is extremely clear water. Visibility here is generally more than a quarter of a mile underwater, which is pretty tremendous. And so we can see these flags and strobe lights that we hang from the downline. And then a lot of people also ask about how we get back out. And it involves taking our gear off underwater, passing it up through the hole, and then climbing out on that ladder that you see there. So if you go to the next slide. One of my favorite questions to ask students is about how wetsuits keep us warmer in the water longer. And that's something that students in southern Delaware, particularly close to the beaches, have a lot of experience with. In this picture, you'll see me under the ice, so you get a good sense of what it's like underneath there, wearing a dry suit. And underneath that dry suit is basically a giant snowsuit, if you will, that I'm wearing that's full of insulators, trapping air, and trying to slow the transfer of heat energy from my body out to the much colder water, trying to slow that down. Go to the next slide. You should be looking at me underneath the ice. This is on surface supply. We do two types of diving here at McMurdo, surface supply, in which we're connected by an air hose back to the hole, and then scuba, which we are untethered for and can explore a little bit farther from the hole and get a better sense of sort of the landscape of the dive site. So I mentioned that we're studying the marine worms that live under there. So we basically go under, collect some worms, and bring them back up to the surface. And that's where the graduate students and scientists get involved in lab work. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see graduate student Stephanie Guida involved in looking for the worms. The worms are very tiny. The worms are approximately 1 inch long and about the thickness of a mechanical pencil lead. So we can't really see them underwater. We're scooping and then putting the sediment that they live in into buckets. And then back at the lab, we're trying to separate the worms from the sediment. That's what Stephanie's doing here. If you go to the next slide, after 4 or 5 hours of sorting through the sediment, Stephanie, and this is Anna Marie, will hopefully find hundreds of worms that can be utilized for their temperature and genetic experiments. And these worms are called Capitella. They're actually a species that is found in disturbed places, places where human beings have been involved in the environment. If you go to the next slide, in addition to tying into your transformation of energy unit and maybe a little bit to your weather unit, another big part of what we're doing down here ties very nicely with your ecosystem unit. And if you'll take a look, a big part of our project is the term adaptation. And at this point, I would, if we were doing this with students, we'd have a little discussion about what that word means to them and what it means to the scientists down here. But basically, I try to convey to most students, eighth graders, that adaptations are either body structures, behaviors, or special skills or processes that these animals utilize to be successful in their environment. Capitella, which is found all over the world, is actually a great example of adaptations. And Dr. Marsh and his team believe that the worm is genetically adapted to living in this very cold water. They're interested in what genes are turned on and what genes are turned off that allow the worms to adapt here. And for those folks who maybe are familiar with the seventh grade curriculum, although Dr. Marsh's genetic work is maybe a little bit above most seventh graders, the genetic information that we try to teach in seventh grade becomes very applicable when we start getting into journals about the genetics work and epigenetics work that Dr. Marsh and his team are doing. So, of course, the enthusiasm that eighth graders really find for this project involve all the underwater photos and video that we are sharing. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see what I mean. Even though it's a frozen wasteland above the ice, below the ice, there's incredible abundance and diversity. And it is amazing to go from that barren wasteland to under the ice where you are just blown away by colors and size and diversity of organisms. And so I think there's a real opportunity here to do some comparison between organisms found in Delaware and organisms found in extreme environments like Antarctica, and to talk a little bit about adaptations, ecosystem, food web, energy flow within that ecosystem, all things that tie very nicely to your eighth grade curriculum. So this is a sea star sitting on top of a sponge. And again, sea stars, great adaptation, tubed feet. For those folks not familiar, the way this organism walks along the bottom is it pumps water into a water vascular system. That water pressure expands these little tube feet on the bottom of the organism, and that's what allows them to kind of extend and move. It's also what allows them to create a vacuum and use those tube feet to suction onto things like clams and open them up. If you go to the next slide, you'll see more sea stars in action. Literally around here, the seafloor is covered with these in some dive sites, thousands of sea stars, all brightly colored like these reds and oranges, also so abundant and so active. If you go to the next slide. One interesting adaptation we see in marine organisms here in Antarctica is gigantism. And if you're looking at the same picture that I am, it's got a sea star bright orange in the middle and then sea urchins around the outside. The sea urchins are the size of the palm of your hand. So that can give you a frame of reference for the sea star in the middle. I've laid this sea star called Macrophycaster across my chest, and even with all my dry suit gear on, the sea star spills over the sides of my body. They are tremendously huge. Another really cool adaptation in this picture is the sea urchins. If you look to the ones to the upper right and upper left, you'll see that they have some algae on them, and they're using that to camouflage, to blend in. A very common occurrence that we see here at McMurdo is sea urchins with things attached to make them look like the bottom. So a great example of another behavioral adaptation. You go to the next slide, Janet. This is a white volcano sponge called Scolomastra. Students don't really know a lot about sea sponges, and so I think it's always an interesting example to show them how different organisms feed. Sea sponges are filter feeders, which means that they filter microscopic food from the water column. And this volcano sponge, some scientists have estimated to be several hundred years old. And actually, it's kind of tough to get a sense of size, but I was on a dive 2 days ago. We found seven of these sponges, and I'm 6 feet tall. They were taller than I was. So pretty amazing in terms of size. You go to the next slide, you'll see the sea sponges come in different colors, shapes, sizes. This was a dive site that is filled with this yellow sponge, Isovictia, and looked sort of like, felt like being in sort of a Dr. Seuss world where these were all over the bottom. Very, 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 very cool. If you go to the next slide, this is a picture of a feather duster worm. I'm going to pause here to take a sip of tea and ask, are you looking at the feather duster worm and the anemone?
Yep.
So this feather duster worm also has an interesting adaptation. It builds tubes like a lot of worms. You can kind of see the tube at the bottom of the picture. The tube is used for protection. The worm moves up and down inside of it and feeds by grabbing material from the water column using those sort of feathery projectiles up at the top. You go to the next slide. Again, students are always excited to see sort of unique or unusual organisms. These are sea spiders. We don't see them a lot in Delaware because sea spiders in temperate waters are usually very small. Down here, these sea spiders are tremendously large, think bigger than the palm of your hand, and all over the bottom, very, very common. Fortunately, another adaptation that organisms use here to conserve energy because food is so limited is they move very slowly. And so sea spiders here, although they're very large and appear somewhat scary, they're actually very slow moving. Next slide shows you a picture of jellyfish. Again, more unique, interesting adaptations, including stinging cells, feeding from the water column using those tentacles. Next slide should show you a sponge and a fish. Again, the fish are very slow moving. If you've ever tried to catch a fish in the water, very, very difficult to do. Typically in Delaware, fish move very quickly. The water makes it sort of difficult to gauge exactly where they are. But when you're underwater and with the fish here in Antarctica, I can catch these with my bare hands. The fish move extremely slowly as an adaptation to conserving energy. If you go to the next slide, you'll see some sea squirts. sponges. And then in the foreground, that purple ribbon sort of looking thing is actually an immersion worm. These worms secrete a mucus on their body that is sort of toxic to other animals and smells quite terrible when you bring them back to the surface. They're about 3 feet long, and they have some interesting adaptations to surviving here. Next slide just shows you more sea urchins and sea stars, but I wanted to show you that picture is not fuzzy. It is actually ice that's forming there, and it's very interesting from under the ice to watch the dynamics of sea ice, of seawater freezing. And that part down the bottom is called anchor ice. Ice actually forms in these very interesting planes and is attached to the bottom. Of course, ice is less dense than water, so if any of this anchor ice is broken off, it will float to the surface and will actually sort of join the sea ice up above. Sometimes organisms stuck in the anchor ice will get a one-way elevator ride up to the surface and get frozen in. So some of these dive sites that we go to, you look up at the ice above you, and you see all these sea stars and urchins stuck in the ice up above. Again, one of the interesting adaptations, as Janet asked about, is why don't these animals freeze? There's been a lot of research done on the fish. Fish actually have certain proteins that act like antifreeze, and some of them have adapted to not using hemoglobin, which is a very energy costly molecule to build and also to pump around your body. The sea stars are actually they're the same temperature as the water. They're 28 degrees, and their enzymes have adapted to be functional at that temperature. So all great questions and great examples for students of both energy and how organisms use energy, and then also adaptations. You go to the next picture. One thing that we're seeing this year is a lot of larval activity under the ice. Last year, the sea ice all broke out, and so they had open water and lots of sunlight during the austral summer. And so this year, we're seeing a lot of larval fish. Pretty amazing. Of course, students are most interested by the charismatic megafauna. So if you go to the next slide, we've had a lot of interaction this year with Weddell seals. Weddell seals have a tremendous number of adaptations that are interesting to students. They're basically little balls of blubber that are quite happy in the 28-degree water or the negative 40-degree air temperatures. Cute little story. Yesterday I was out at a dive site, and a seal had moved into our dive hut, and we had to kind of shoo him back into the water. Got real close to the seal, and then also saw the seal again later on during the dive. And although they are awkward and goofy-looking on top of the water, in the water they are graceful torpedoes. And again, that streamlined shape is another very neat adaptation. If you go to the next slide, again, everyone says, oh, how cute, such a cute little seal pup. I'll go ahead and ruin it for you. They stink something terribly. and they are not the best house guests you could wish for. If you go to the next slide, you'll see another example of charismatic megafauna that the students are all excited by. We have two species of penguin. The left is the emperor penguin. Stands about 3 feet tall. It is the largest penguin species in the world. And again, the only animal that is adapted to winters on the Antarctic. I'm sure very popular and famous movie that you might have all seen is March of the Penguins, which sort of documents their life cycle and pretty amazing. The right is sort of the more comical and forgotten. This is the Adelie penguin. If you have any younger children and they've seen Happy Feet, these are kind of the cute little comical birds. I think they were voiced by Robin Williams. And they kind of travel along the sea ice very quickly, tend to fall down a lot, stumbling over the ice and the different structures that exist on the ice, and then sort of toboggan along. They slide on their bodies. But again, all adaptations, very torpedo-shaped, very streamlined in the water. Next slide is just a beautiful shot of emperor penguins from Scott Base right next door to McMurdo. And so one sort of last way that I think you might be interested in tying this in with your students is there's a tremendous amount of work being done here to conserve energy. And to find other sources. There's a tremendous amount of wind here, and I know it's kind of hard to see in this picture, but that blue arrow is pointing to some recently installed turbines that are up on the hill. Scott Base, which is the New Zealand station right next door to us, actually generates all of its electricity that it uses by using wind turbines, and actually has a surplus. It gives some of its energy back to the United States McMurdo Station. Solar panels are very useful in the summertime, particularly in field camps. We get 24 hours of sunlight here. Again, very not useful in the wintertime. And there are some problems with the temperatures that these solar panels are exposed to. All around station, you'll see signs asking people to reduce consumption. It costs energy to produce all the fresh water that we use. So we're asked to kind of curtail showers, turn off lights. And all of this has kind of been brought to a forefront this year because there was talk that the icebreaker, which typically services McMurdo Station and allows a supply ship to come in, might not be available. And as soon as that became a possibility, really everyone started looking very carefully about the fuel on hand and how we use the fuel, the wind turbines, and could we get more energy out of that. So all very interesting. As a good educator, I've asked a lot of you this afternoon your time and attention, but I also offer something in return. If you go to our website, www.polartrek.com, you'll see our expedition, and I know Janet posted that in the text. So Chris and John, if you'd be willing to share that. We have been journaling. We have about 50 journals that are sort of a blend of science and life here at McMurdo Station. Those are freely available. You may use them however you choose in your classroom. They make great reading pieces and then also great photos. There's a separate section of our website called Ask the Team where your students can submit questions to us here and we will answer them in real time. And that has been a pretty productive part of our website. We've got some great questions that have inspired some journals. And then finally, what you just experienced is called a Polar Connect event. And just like we did for you guys in the classroom today, we can also do for your students. And so we'll have another Polar Connect event coming up next week that we will be advertising on the website very soon. And your students can listen in and ask questions, just as you are about to do. So, again, I appreciate all your time and attention, but I am offering something here in return, and Polar Truck is offering something big here in return. So if you go to the next slide, Janet should say questions, and I'm going to go ahead and take my hand off the talk button and allow teachers and Chris, kind of you can organize this, the questions.
All right, Mike, thank you very much. Janet, sorry, I didn't mean to stomp on top of you there. We have a question, and we're going to have a few. Most of your presentation answered the vast majority of the questions that my students have generated, but a couple of us have come up with some questions as you went. I do have one just to kind of start us off. What did you do or how did you prepare for this expedition?
Great. And, again, you could kind of pose that to students and say, what would you do to prepare for a two-month-long expedition to Antarctica? And then we also have a journal entry that sort of documents my preparation process, a couple of them. But here's kind of the long and the short of it. It's a multi-step process. As with most of our job, it involves a lot of paperwork. Teachers are quite good at, working the papers and filling out forms. So you have to be what's called physically qualified. That involves a rather thorough physical and dental inspection and a lot of blood work. Once you're signed off on that, you work with the travel department to get tickets. They fly us across the United States and then across the Pacific Ocean to New Zealand. You spend a couple of days in New Zealand getting your ECW gear and trying it all on, making sure it all fits. And then you fly down from New Zealand to McMurdo Station in a Air Force C-17, which I left out of today's presentation, but you can go to the website and see our journal on it. Again, another really powerful thing with eighth graders, particularly boys, these large military airplanes that flies down. Then there were a lot of other things, prepping things at my home and my classroom, of course. Polar Trek is a fabulous program. One of the things that it does is while you're away, it pays for your substitute. And so I had to leave some rather detailed plans, and thanks to the help of John Moyer and some colleagues at school, my substitute is currently, like you, teaching transformations of energy.
All right, thanks. I have another one. Have you noticed any changes, either physiologically or emotionally, due to the changes in atmospheric pressure, temperature? I mean, it's a great deal of it's very different there than it is in Delaware. So can you give us kind of a feel for what you've noticed or what you felt?
Yeah, great question. So one kind of interesting part of this is coming in at Windfly in August, you meet a lot of people who wintered over. These are people that haven't seen sunlight in several months. They've worked in extremely cold temperatures at doing some very hard things. That definitely takes a physiological and emotional toll on them. Altitude is actually not so much of a problem for us here at McMurdo. The station is pretty much right at sea level. If you were at South Pole Station, Edmondson Scott Base, that would be a slightly different story. Altitude sickness and stuff like that is a definite possibility. In terms of physiological and sort of physical changes, for myself, here are just a couple. Number one, I drink a ton of water here. If you can picture a Nalgene bottle that holds, 32 ounces of fluid, I drink like 5 of those a day. It is extremely dry here. You are constantly losing moisture with every exhalation. A second thing is, as Chris has asked, I've done about 25 dives so far, and because of all that time I spend either outside or in the water, my body has sort of upregulated its thermal output. The very first night after I did a dive, I laid in bed and I realized that I was like roasting on fire. My body was converting all those calories to heat energy. And so as a nice byproduct of that, I can pretty much eat whatever I want. I have 3 gigantic meals a day. and so, yeah, Chris, you're spot on. My caloric consumption is huge. I don't even want to guess, but it's got to be in 5,000 to 6,000 calorie range. And for those folks who say, whoa, Mike, slow down. I haven't gained a single pound. I'm 6 feet, I weigh 150 pounds. So all those calories that I'm taking in are being converted right to heat. I'll just keep going. Chris is asking great questions in the text. We have a galley. They produce food typical of a middle school cafeteria or a college dining hall. I'm eating a lot of pastas, carbohydrates, things like that. They have proteins like fish. One thing that we haven't seen in several weeks is fresh food. So salads and greens would be really nice. Fresh fruit would be tremendous. All things that we're missing. And yeah, thanks, Janet. I forgot that we put some slides at the end there. You guys can see the galley, and I think there's also a shot of a plate of food. So yeah, great questions.
A couple light questions. Do you wear sunscreen? Do you have concerns of being sunburned, even though the sun's lower in the sky? And anything particular about ozone or ozone layer depletion in that area?
Yeah, all great questions. And when you guys get to the electromagnetic waves portion of the curriculum, you'll do some interesting stuff with some UV beads, which I think is really cool, and talk a little bit about the energy that comes from the sun and sunlight and how it gets to Earth. You're right. The timing of the year makes it so that I can really get away without much sunscreen, sort of low-level lights, not very intense. And then also I do wear sunglasses pretty much all the time for those folks that are interested. And, again, when you get to energy waves, one of the interesting things about energy waves when they hit different materials is they either reflect, transmit, or are absorbed. And snow, as it turns out, is a very good reflector of sunlight. And so if you're familiar with the injury called snow blindness, it's because of all that ultraviolet and light that's being reflected by the snow back up into your face that your eyes can be really injured by a lot of sunlight. So right now, at this time of year, you can get away with just wearing your sunglasses a lot, and you don't really need to worry about sunscreen. But come summertime, you'll see people lather up sunscreen before going out to work, which is kind of a little ironic, but very necessary.
Okay. something else. When you talked about the worms, you said they were only from human disturbance. Can you give me a little more information on how they're being humanly disturbed up there, or you know, where that's coming from?
Yeah, so I, with students, I kind of handle this a little more carefully because it creates quite an uproar. But McMurdo Station has been here since the late 1950s. It was first founded by the Navy. And for some of the more experienced and wiser folks in the room, shall we say, you'll know that human beings have not always been the best at handling our trash and our waste. And McMurdo Station, for many, many years, dumped trash out onto the ice and let it sink. We're actually dumping straight into the ocean. The same thing with our wastewater. And so actually at the bottom, at a particular dive site, we can actually dive onto sort of the waste pile. And these worms are given a tremendous advantage by organically enriched sediment. And so places where we've dumped our waste, we tend to find these worms in rather high densities. But elsewhere around the continent, they are not found. And so this makes a rather interesting system of study because you really only have one point source of pollution. You know, that you see the difference in distribution and abundance of certain species. I need to immediately follow that up by saying McMurdo Station has improved tremendously in the way we handle our waste, and that has been a major point of emphasis for the last decade or so. And lots of scientists have been documenting the monitoring and the cleanup. One of the scientists on our team, Dr. Stacy Kim, has spent quite a bit of time underwater documenting how the waste has been broken down by the environment and how it's changed now that there is no input of waste into the system. And for those folks that are really interested in that, there will be a journal entry coming up in the next week or so about how McMurdo Station handles all its waste. It's all sorted and shipped back to the United States. The majority of it is recycled. And then the wastewater treatment plant does an excellent job of treating the human waste. Chris, you asked about dives. 22 dives so far. Average depth has been between 60 and 100 feet. I think my deepest dive was 115 feet. Your face is the only part of your body that's really directly exposed to the water. And it's not your entire face. If you can picture back to the images of us diving, we wear a mask that covers sort of a large portion of our forehead and down around our nose. That kind of covers our eyes and all that. So there's air in there. And then the regulator in our mouth actually covers up a large portion of our lower face. We have hoods that cover our all the way around our ears and the sides. And so really the only part that's exposed is a part sort of around our lips, and it goes numb almost instantly. So you just lose feeling in that for the duration of the dive. I will say that the rest of your body does feel the effects. My average dive time has been about 45 minutes, and 45 minutes in 28-degree water, by the time you're done, your body's ready for some heat from the dive hut before you make your second dive. All great questions.
I have one. We're coming to an end. I have one last question that's a little different. You said that the starfish, they have certain proteins in them that stop them from freezing. And just as a personal question on myself, are they studying those proteins for like cryogenics and stuff to see, you know, how they have this natural antifreeze, and you know, if maybe we can apply that to, you know, the study of cryogenics?
Yeah, great question, and it actually has some broader implications as well. Scientists are really interested in how these proteins are folded and organized and how they are active at such cold temperatures. Because if you can understand how those mechanisms work, you can apply that to other enzymes as well, and enzymes that we need for certain industrial, pharmaceutical processes. A great example of that is sort of biofuels. If anyone's familiar with the projects that are trying to use algaes to create sort of fuel sources that are sustainable, those processes require enzymes that function at certain temperatures and certain pHs, and st- studying the animals down here gives us some better insight into how those enzymes and proteins are structured and how we can maybe apply that structure to those enzymes to make those processes function. So, yeah, great question, and definitely some applications. The question is, how did I get interested in all this? And the answer is it was actually the diving that brought me here. I've been here twice, 2005 and then this year, and each time has been a really magical experience, a tremendous experience, and once you're down here, you'll find that learning about this is highly addictive. All these interesting animals and adaptations. And I think you'll find the same thing with your students too. So I'm hoping that you'll open up this little world to them. Again, use the website as much or as little as you like. That's one of the strengths of the program. You can pick and choose what you integrate into your curriculum. And as I've tried to point out this afternoon, I think a lot of this lends itself nicely to all four units that you teach, but especially transformations of energy, ecosystems, and maybe a little bit to the weather. So I'll take this opportunity, Chris said that's your last question, to say thank you very much for your time, and thanks to John and Chris for helping to put this together. I hope this has been a worthwhile part of your training, and I hope you guys enjoy the rest of your transformation of energy training. It's one of my favorite units, and I hope you take a lot of it back to your students.
Mike, I want to thank you for all of this. You're definitely doing some great research there. You're a far better man than I, because there's no way I'm going up there and freezing to death. We thank you for your time. Be safe. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks, everyone.
All right. Thank you all for joining us. That was a great presentation, and we're going to stop the archive right now.